This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 83. Today we speak with Guy Richard about the theology of Samuel Rutherford. Christ the Center is listener-supported. To read more about how you can contribute, please visit reformedforum.org/support. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, a weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I have with me today Jeff Waddington, who's teacher of the congregation at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. How are you doing, Jeff?
Hey, I'm doing fine, Camden, and I need to tell you that I may not be swinging, but the microphone is.
Okay, nice. Yeah, Jeff got some new equipment, so we're excited for that. And the last episode, he used the mic, and now he's got this fantastic little boom arm. So If you hear Jeff tinkering around during the show, it's because he's fiddling with his new mic stand. And yeah. Just want to point out, I did introduce Jeff before our good friend Nick Batzig, who's church planter in Richmond Hill, Georgia. It's great to have you back, Nick.
It's good to be on, Camden. I'm using a crummy old headset.
Yep. Well, we'll get you figured out someday. So we are very pleased to have on with us Guy Richard, who is a senior minister at First Presbyterian Church in Gulfport, Mississippi. He's been the author of numerous articles on Samuel Rutherford and Puritan theology, and we're going to speak with him about Rutherford today. Guy, thank you very much for joining us. We're excited to have you on.
Well, thank you for having me. It's good to be with you.
Yeah. Well, before we get started, we don't have any new book stuff to mention per se, but Jeff, you do have one item to mention, don't you?
Yes, I just wanted to mention, in addition to the book that we're going to be talking with Guy about, is a chapter that he co-authored with John Fesco entitled Natural Theology and the Westminster Confession is finally available in Volume 3 of the Westminster Confession into the 21st Century. That's the volume with the orangish cover with, I think it's an airplane, right, on the front of the cover?
I think so, yeah. We've taken a look at the other two volumes. You can go back in the archives, and we have an interview with Ligon Duncan speaking about Volume 1, I believe it was.
Yes.
And I'll put a link to that in the show notes if I remember. I always need to say that if I remember.
Yeah,
and that's a good book to get. You're really going to enjoy those collection of articles. They're always very edifying. So if you want to get up-to-date book news and reviews, you can listen to the Reformed Media Review. You can visit reformedforum.org/RMR. But we're recording a little bit in advance, so it isn't as prudent for us to put that information into this program at this time. So we'll split that out and put it in another feed for those who actually want to get it. But today we're going to be speaking about, as I mentioned, Samuel Rutherford. And Guy has written a book entitled The Supremacy of God and the Theology of Samuel Rutherford. Guy's done a lot of work and a lot of research on Rutherford and has really opened up the studies. Many of Rutherford's works are not available to all the English readers because many of them are still in Latin. But Guy has translated some of these works, and he wrote a dissertation on this. Nick, you got to speak with Guy, and we've got an interview with him or some clips that we're going to be putting out eventually down at the General Assembly of the PCA. Could you just describe a little bit about what you talked about and explain why and where we're going to go today with this discussion?
Sure. A lot of my friends are friends with Guy, and so I was glad to finally get to meet him down at the General Assembly. And I think before maybe we talk about Rutherford, Guy, I was hoping you could tell our listeners a little bit about the circumstances surrounding your call to Gulfport, just because, especially within the PCA, I know a lot of my friends were involved in the events right after Katrina. Would you mind just sharing some of that just very briefly with our listeners?
Would be happy to. It has been an interesting 4 years that I've been here in Gulfport. When I was leaving Edinburgh, Scotland, which is where I was prior to coming to Gulfport, finishing up my doctoral work on Rutherford, the church here called me to be the minister, and about, I guess, two or three months after they called me to be the senior minister here, Hurricane Katrina came through, and the eye of the hurricane passed no more than probably 15 minutes from where we are, and it completely destroyed the church. It wiped out about a third of the homes, or a third of the members of their homes completely. We had a great deal of loss, probably something like about $4 million worth of damage to the church facility itself.
Oh.
And we actually had to tear down the facility, but we spent 2 years after the hurricane from end of 2005 all the way through the end of 2007 doing recovery work and trying to clean out homes and help people rebuild. Most of the individuals in our congregation did not have insurance. The way insurance works down here on the coast, just briefly, there is no such thing as hurricane insurance, even though we might wish or think that there was. They have homeowners insurance, which covers everything but hurricanes, and they have a special wind policy that they call, which does not cover flood insurance. Even though floodwaters may come in with a hurricane with the strong winds, they are not covered unless you have a separate flood policy. Well, most of the people in the congregation had wind coverage and thought they were covered, but did not have flood coverage. And so we had to go in and rebuild homes, and we did, started a ministry called Camp Hope, which was situated on some property that we owned as a church, and volunteers from all over the country, all over the world actually, came in town for 2 years and stayed with us and helped us to rebuild and donated and gave to us financially, and we were able to, in God's providence, help hundreds and hundreds of homeowners in the community to get back into their homes.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Now, Guy, was it your intention to go to teach at a seminary after you did your doctoral studies before you took the call to the church in Gulfport?
Well, it really was. That was the reason that I went to do the PhD. My thinking was my gifts are more teaching than they were preaching and pastoring. But God just changed my heart and my wife's heart while we were in Edinburgh, and we were working alongside a church there in Edinburgh, St. Columba's Free Church, Free Church of Scotland, in Edinburgh, kind of as a, if you want to call it, an unofficial assistant minister, assistant to the pastor. And I think that, along with the years that I spent in Jackson working at First Presbyterian Church in Jackson under Ligon Duncan there, gave me a real burden for the local church. And I think, in one sense, the real frontline ministry that we see, that we face, is in the local congregation. And so God just changed our hearts, and we really felt the call to come here and be a part of this local congregation here.
Now, Guy, you have a pretty substantive dissertation on Rutherford, which I learned when we talked that you had translated one of Rutherford's works, correct my pronunciation, the Examen Arminianisme, is that right? Arminianisme?
Examen, okay. Arminianisme, that's correct.
And can you explain why that work, what was special about that work, what led you to that work, and just the background leading up to your doctoral studies in that regard?
I'd be happy to. The Examen Arminianisme literally is, in English, means an examination of Arminianism. And what that work is, it's still in Latin today. I translated that work. It is an extremely rare treatise. It is only found in only the largest and best or most well-stocked libraries. But that work is actually a compilation of all of Rutherford's lectures while he was at St. Andrews University. He was a professor of divinity from 1639 until he died in 1661, eventually became the principal of St. Mary's College at St. Andrews. And these were his lectures, his theology lectures that he delivered during his time there. They were delivered in Latin, his notes were in Latin, and his wife, when he died, took these notes and she sent them over to some friends in the Netherlands, and they pulled all of them together and published them after he died in 1668.
Now, Guy, are you planning on publishing that translation?
Well, I would like to. I certainly would like to. The question is going to be whether I have the time to be able to pull everything together. Most of the translation is in very rough form right now, and I did publish a piece of the translation. The Examen, the thing that makes it special, is this is as close as we get to Rutherford's systematic theology. he had no proper systematic theology text, but if you had to designate one of his works that's as close as we get, it would be the XMN. It consists of 20 chapters. The first chapter is Revelation, and he goes from Revelation all the way through to the last chapter, chapter 20, is eschatology. And he deals with the loci of systematic theology, if you will, all the way through, albeit with a polemical bent, because he's dealing with Arminianism, and in each case he's trying to debunk Arminianism. But it is the most systematic and the most theological of all of Rutherford's works, and the least polemical of all of Rutherford's works. And so I think it's an extremely important work to get out there and to have more readily available. And so one of the reasons that I did my thesis the way I did, in this book the way I did, is I took Rutherford's theology from Revelation all the way through soteriology, through the end of Assurance of Salvation. And I wanted to, the main thing I wanted to do was to get Rutherford's theology out there. And so I did less arguing of a specific thesis and more of a presentation of this is Rutherford's theology. And I did engage in actually a little bit of an argumentation, and I do have a thesis that I'm trying to prove throughout the whole book. But one of my main goals in writing this was to give a presentation of Rutherford's theology in its most succinct and systematic form possible.
And that's, Guy, is really what we want. Before we can get to evaluation, we need to know what someone has actually said. So that you've done us a great service. We'd like to see that. Do you have an idea of how many pages that would be? If you were able to get it published?
I am not sure. In the original text, it is somewhere in the vicinity of about 800 pages, quarto,
okay.
If I remember correctly. I haven't gone back to look at what my... I've got it in several different Word documents. I did publish... the Confessional Presbyterian Journal asked me to publish a section of it, and I spun off a chapter, I think it might have been chapter 19, from the XMN. I spun it off. It was on Rutherford's view of the civil magistrate.
Oh, yes,
things and put that in. It was a little bit more polished up than what the rest of my translation is.
Speaking of his views on civil government, some people have suggested that Rutherford had really laid the foundation for people like Thomas Hobbes or John Locke. Could you speak about his particular views on civil government and what he contributed to the world of Presbyterianism?
Well, I can speak to it to some degree, although there are men that have definitely studied that aspect in Rutherford much more than I have. Of the areas that Rutherford received a lot of attention, one would be his letters, and a lot of attention has been devoted to Rutherford. Rightly so, I think, in dealing with his letters and what Rutherford is doing in his letters. But also the other area would be his ecclesiology, and then also his idea of church-state relations.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the areas that really have been given a lot of attention. And so there is a good bit in print on Rutherford in those areas, and less so on his theology. So most of what I was concentrating on was his theology.
Yes, okay. That's really interesting. I mean, thinking about everything that was going on at that time period, in the 17th century, the early 17th century when he was active, and, just considering many in conservative Presbyterianism today have their views formed from Rutherford and the Westminster Standards, etc.
And no doubt, Lex Rex was extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Lex Rex is still studied in the University of Edinburgh still today.
Wow.
Their political science classes, they still read and interact with that book still today in the 21st century. But it obviously shaped many of the views that impacted or affected our own American Revolution.
Right.
So.
Now, I do believe that he would have been put to death for that book had he not been ill, I think. Isn't that true?
That's correct. Guy? That's correct. He was summoned to appear before the Court of High Commission in 1661. He was on his deathbed. I think it was about February or so when he was summoned of 1661. And he sent back a reply saying that he could not appear. He was being summoned or answering a summons from a higher court.
Now, Guy, moving back to your study, although it would be great just to talk about Rutherford's influence upon what, Calvinistic political philosophy, but going back to your book, you deal with a significant historiographical, that is the study of history. You deal with a significant historiographical debate that goes on within Calvinist studies, and that is the Calvin versus the Calvinist debate. Can you shed a little light on that broader debate and then how it relates to Rutherford?
Sure can. I felt like it was important for me to take up that issue, and when you take up Rutherford, so many people that have written about Rutherford's theology in the secondary literature have accused him of being out of line, or being a hyper-Calvinist, actually being out of line, out of accord with John Calvin. And so there's rage, this debate with the Scottish Bardians on the one hand. That's kind of been the ones with T.F. Torrance and Charles Bell and some of these guys that have really fueled that fire in Scotland, that have accused Rutherford, among others, but Rutherford, since we're talking about him, as being out of accord with John Calvin, that he is one of the Calvinists, quote-unquote, and they hardened John Calvin's theology. They took many of the more gracious or the more the topics of Calvin's theology that he left in a little more pastoral condition, so to speak, and that men like Rutherford hardened those things and made them much more capricious, much more hardened, and much less pastoral. And I think, obviously, and what their argument would be is, as a result, they drifted from John Calvin's theology, and they were no longer faithful to John Calvin. And so in writing about Rutherford's theology, I felt like I had to address that issue, that argument, where it was wrong. And one of the things I tried to prove throughout the course of the thesis, that was in fact wrong, that although Rutherford no doubt does things and says things that John Calvin did not do or say, but he is faithful on the whole to John Calvin's theology, much more so than what many of the men before me have said in print.
Now, would you describe then his relationship to Calvin as one of continuity and development?
Absolutely.
That's not the you don't use the language of development, but I think that summarizes what you're getting at in the book.
That's right. I would use Richard Muller. Richard Muller has done a lot of work on the relationship between the Reformation and the post-Reformation period, and his four-volume series on post-Reformation Reformed Dogmatics is an absolute gem. Mm. And I've heard he's working on a couple other things right now as well. But I think what Muller's basic thesis is correct, and it's substantiated in Rutherford, that what you see as you move from Calvin, or even within Calvin's own life, is you see a further structuring or a systematizing that's going on even within Calvin's own lifetime. As you come from the Reformation, what they begin to see is the need then not only to rethink one doctrine, justification by faith alone, or two doctrines, sola scriptura and or five doctrines, so to speak, the five solas, but they see that they've got to now rethink and systematize and structure an entire worldview, an entire way of life. And you see that systematizing going on in Calvin's own life, and I think it continues in the next generations, and you see the same tendency in Rutherford. He is faithful to the theology, but you see a further structuring. Many of the men like Rutherford, who would be called scholastics, embraced that methodology of scholasticism, that medieval scholastic methodology, because it helped them to be able to systematize and to get their heads around this theology and to systematize and categorize the theology they were trying to express and communicate.
Would you say that the chapter in your book and in Rutherford's work itself on the doctrine of God, it is the most significant in the sense, just following up on what you're saying, that he is building off of Anselm, I think you mentioned, and maybe Duns Scotus, and the ontological argument that God is the being of which there is none greater, that he is looking at the perfections of God, and that is really at the heart of his contention against Arminianism.
Yes, I think that is the key, and that's why I entitled the book The Supremacy of God in the Theology of Samuel Rutherford, because I think that is the vital element in Rutherford's theology. He had a, his God was supreme. His God was, if you want to use this word, although I might want to, put a little caveat by it, his God was radically exalted. I mean, his God was reigned and ruled on high, and there wasn't any doubt in his mind about it, and he saw any system of thought that sought to undermine that as being from the devil.
So would you say that he embodies what is sometimes referred to today as a, or he held to what it sometimes called a perfect being theology?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. That's the language usually used for folk like Anselm, Augustine,
right,
and Aquinas.
How does that work itself out in the discussion about the necessity of God? Because I know in the interview I had with you down at GA, we focused a lot on the issue of Rutherford's superlapsarianism, and how does Rutherford's doctrine of God and the perfection of God and the freedom of God and the and all of that, the aseity of God, his self-sufficiency, play into the discussion of his works toward us as creatures in creation and redemption?
Hmm. Yes, Rutherford had some peculiar ideas that you see to some degree in woven into different figures throughout the medieval period and even into the Reformation and post-Reformation as well. But Rutherford believed, because his God was, and I think because he had such a high concept of God, it manifested itself in several peculiar peculiar to Rutherford, specific to Rutherford views on salvation. He was a voluntarist. I think we talked about that before. And basically what that meant was he believed that within the divine psychology, within God, God's will was sovereign over God's mind, if you will. In other words, men like John Owen were intellectualists. They believed that God's nature, God's intellect, if you will, who God was, his being, forced or compelled God's will certain things and to not will other things. So the fact that God was just, John Owen would say, in and of himself, meant that bound him, if you will, to be just towards his creatures. Well, Rutherford was the exact opposite. He was a voluntarist. And Rutherford believed that God could choose to be just, although God was just in and of himself, he could choose to be just or not be just towards his creatures. And one of the most fundamental reasons, or one of the reasons why Rutherford believed that, he said, if God is by nature just and by nature merciful, then that would mean, if we were intellectualists, that God would have to be just to every person on the face of the globe, and God would have to be merciful to every person on the face of the globe. And it forced him into this voluntaristic position where God could choose to be just or choose to be merciful to his creatures. And the way that worked out in salvation is that Rutherford believed that God did not have to send Jesus. He did not have to... God could have taken sin, he could have swept it under the rug if he wanted to. He could have just chosen not to be just and not to bring his justice to bear upon the sin of humankind. And he also could have chosen to forgive sin by some other way besides Jesus. And there are a lot of views like that Rutherford believed, that God was free in what he chose to do because he believed that God's will was sovereign and that his being did not... force him or compel him to deal with his creatures in any way whatsoever.
Now, Guy, how did Rutherford deal with the objection that such a view would make God capricious? In other words, so what would prevent him from changing his mind halfway through history and say, "Oh, all those who trust in Christ are damned"?
Right. Well, there were several things. Rutherford believed there were several things that kind of worked alongside with that, so it wasn't quite as straightforward as what I was trying to make it to sound. The concept of love, Rutherford admitted that the concept of love did mitigate and affect and incline, if you will, the will and the choices and the decisions that the will would do. But the most important mitigation on that, or the most important exception to bring up, is the idea of non-contradiction, and the idea that God is immutable, that he cannot change. Once God decrees anything, that decree is immutable. It is written in stone, and God cannot change. And so what Ruth would go back to say is that before God decided in the divine decrees, before the creation of the world, the universe, God decided, or had a decision to make, basically, will I be just to my creatures? And if I'm going to be just to my creatures, will I then be merciful to my creatures? And in order to show his glory in his wisdom and in the mysteries of his wisdom, he decided that he would, yes, I will reveal my glory to my creatures and to those who are not my creatures by being just towards all men and then by being merciful towards all men in Christ. And so from that point in the divine decrees, the atonement of Christ obviously was necessary. But up to that point in the divine decrees, the forgiveness and forgiveness by Christ or some other way, all of those things were open to God, and he could have chosen and done anything he wanted to do.
So you're getting at basically the distinction that we often talk about between God's absolute power, or the potentia or absoluta, or the ordained power, right? Or
that's
potentia
correct.
Ordinata.
That's right. What Ruther was really concerned to protect was God's absolute freedom and power, that God had free will, and that was one of the most fundamental arguments that he had with the Arminians. Here the Arminians were putting all their eggs in the basket of human freedom, and they were willing to sacrifice the freedom of God's will, you know, saying that human free will was greater and, if you will, had more sovereignty than God's free will. And Ruther was saying, no. You know,
right.
God's will is sovereign. God's will is absolute. He does whatsoever he wants, and because he does it, it is good, it is right, and it is best, because he does it, because he is God.
The guy, let's kind of backtrack if we can. Can you paint for us a picture of the historical context, which you do well in your book, that gives rise, how does Arminianism, whether it's of, you know, directly connected to Jacob Arminius or James Arminius, you know, you discussed that in some
right.
detail in the book. Can you give us a brief or a lengthy historical discussion of the reason why Rutherford is captivated with this problem?
Well, it was a problem within Scotland, and it is kind of a little bit mysterious, a little bit confusing as to, or inexact as to when this became a serious problem within Scotland, but apparently it did become a big problem within Scotland and was catching on like wildfire. There's a comment, if I remember correctly, the Westminster divine with the journals.
Bailey,
thank you.
Or is it Henderson? Or Henderson, maybe. It may be Henderson.
No, I think it was Bailey.
Okay.
Who made the comment that it was that Arminianism, when it came into Scotland, had all of a sudden crept into all of the universities. It was like this wildfire that swept into the universities and was taking the universities by storm. And so Rutherford saw this as an attack upon God and his view of God, but attack upon at the heart of Christianity. And I don't have the quote on off the top of my head. One of you may have seen it more recently.
I did, but I can't remember.
He says something about how Arminians are not even converted, which, you know, I don't know if any of us want to go there.
Right.
I don't know if any of us want to go there today, because, you know, we can all say we have dear Arminian brothers and sisters and friends that and family members probably and the rest of it, but Ruther would go so far as to say that Arminians were not even converted because they exalted, they so denigrated the sovereignty of God to such a degree and put themselves, he would say, on the throne of the universe that they could not possibly be Christian.
And you see something of that historical interaction between Owen and the Arminians too in Death of Death. I remember the first time I read that thinking, wow, you know, this is pretty strong against Arminianism. But the historical context, the Arminians were really attacking Calvinism, yes, in a strong way, and were making it the target of their animosity, right?
Right.
That's right. And the way it actually worked out within the whole context is it kind of crept in, if you will, with a counter-Reformation movement. This is one of the fundamental themes in my book, is that Arminianism came into Scotland differently. Arminianism came into Scotland wedded to an episcopacy, an ecclesiastical desire for for prelacy, for the episcopal form of church government. And so you putting those two things together, many of the men, like Rutherford, saw this as a return to Rome. And they were going to fight against this because they saw everything that had started with John Knox in 1560, everything they had staked their livelihoods on, everything they had put their, you know, their careers on, everything they had believed in since 1560 was now at stake. And Arminianism coming into Scotland together with William Laud's episcopacy, the two of them together, they saw as nothing more or less than a return to Rome, except perhaps without the Pope.
Right. Hey, Guy, I have two questions. Let's see if I can keep them clear in my head. One is, piggybacking on what you've just said, what was the doctrine of justification that Arminianism held? And then the second question will be actually more of a hypothetical, and that is, we as you've already indicated, we take a slightly different view of our Arminian brothers, and what we may want to mention is that there was a historical movement that intervenes between the time of Rutherford and ourselves, and that is the Wesleyan Methodist movement, which gives Arminianism a slightly different cast. And so I was wondering if you think that Rutherford or even Owen would have a different assessment of Wesleyan Arminianism as over against the more pure form that comes from the Netherlands. So the first question is, what is the Arminian doctrine of justification that is really the base, if I understood you right, is the basis for the concern of Rutherford and others, not just the doctrine of predestination or conditional election, but also what is the effect of that on justification? And then the second question, which is the hypothetical one.
Yes, you may have to help me along. It's been a while since I've looked through some of my notes and things, but if I remember correctly, yeah, that's always a good sign that you're getting old there. But if I remember correctly, the Arminian doctrine of justification wasn't where Rutherford's main problem was in their doctrine of justification per se. It was in their doctrine of faith.
Yes, that's correct.
When you bring their doctrine of faith in and you say that someone's justified by faith because of their doctrine of faith, and this idea of the way the Arminians define faith, leaving it open for faith basically to be a work.
That's correct.
A work that was something that we did in order to gain our salvation. Because of that,
what it becomes is faith is the stress in Arminianism, if I understand it correctly, and I'm a former Wesleyan Arminian, so it's hitting a little too close to home, I guess. The faith in the Arminian scheme, of course, the focus falls upon the quality of the faith rather than upon the object of faith, which is Christ.
Correct. That's right.
And that's one of the problems, right, is faith itself becomes a work, and it's you'll see this in our day in the work of someone like Robert Gundry. You may be familiar with his debate with John Piper on the imputation of Christ's act of obedience and justification. In that debate, of course, Gundry rejects imputation and says that the faith, for instance, for which Abraham is justified on the basis of his faith, not on the basis of the righteousness of the one who in whom Abraham put his faith. So that this is a continuing, this is a live issue.
Right.
So that's very, that's an interesting problem. And of course, so the second question was, do you think Rutherford would have a different assessment of Wesleyan Arminianism, or would it be basically the same judgment?
That's a good question. I think it's possible that Rutherford would have had a, it's always hard to transplant someone into, you know, there,
right.
there are two things that are hard. One is to, when we're looking at a 17th century figure or a 16th century figure or an 18th century figure, we tend to oftentimes evaluate that figure according to our own day and time and the criteria and the judgments of our own day and time, and we import that back into theirs. But I think it's also equally risky or equally difficult, as difficult as it is to keep our own day and our own judgments from affecting the way we evaluate a 17th century figure, but to import him into a different period is also equally difficult. Rutherford was such an intolerant person, so to speak. With, I say intolerant there in a good sense. He believed in the truth.
Right.
And he believed in defending the truth. And anything that subverted the truth and anything that attacked the doctrine of God, Rutherford was vehemently opposed to. So I don't know. To answer your question, I can see Rutherford being stridently opposed to it today in the 18th century. I can see him being maybe a little more gracious toward it.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, in terms of our own assessment of Arminianism in our own day. As you've already said, we have, you know, we may consider them brothers and sisters, which seems like a view that he wouldn't have taken, right?
Right, I think so. I mean, I may be wrong on that, but Rutherford was not known for being charitable. Quite simply, when someone disagreed with him, or when someone took a position that he saw as undercutting the sovereignty of God or the glory of Jesus in any way, Rutherford was so concerned for the truth and so God-centered, if you will, or to use another, a Piper term, as you were talking about John Piper, God-besotted. I mean, he was just so saturated, right, with God that any kind of a attack or any kind of a smudge on his God and the beauty of his God, Rutherford attacked with vehemence.
Well, that's what makes him attractive, is to me, at least, because he's different, right?
Absolutely.
Now, tell us about, because we haven't even touched upon this, and that is the fact that Samuel Rutherford was one of the Scottish commissioners to the Westminster Assembly. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, Rutherford was one of the men who was chosen. Rutherford was chosen specifically because of the treatise that he wrote. I think it was the second treatise that he wrote, A Peaceable and Temperate Plea for Paul's Presbytery in Scotland, in 1642. When that came out, Rutherford was chosen. We're told in the history books that there was another gentleman who was ahead of Rutherford on their, in the minds of whoever was doing the choosing denominationally. And when Rutherford published that book on Paul's Presbytery, they saw that as a work that merited Rutherford going, and he went. He was there at the assembly longer than any other of the Scottish commissioners, Scottish divines who were there. He apparently, according to Mitchell's minutes, he was commended by the assembly and the only commissioner, the only divine, Scottish divine, to be commended by the assembly for his constant attendance in all of their debates. Gillespie was there for quite a while, but traveled away and left because of illness, and the same is true for the other Scottish commissioners who were there, divines who were there, excuse me. But Rutherford was there more consistently, and he apparently was more faithful in his attendance, and I think for all of those reasons, besides his personality and his hatred of any kind of error, I think Rutherford had a huge impact upon the assembly. You guys, I'm sure, know Chad Van Dixhorn and
yes.
the work that Chad is doing on the assembly. Chad and I spoke many years ago now, and I don't want to hold Chad to this because we just spoke off the cuff, but he did tell me that Rutherford at that time was the second most prominent speaker on the floor of the assembly, and all of his discoveries that he had unearthed, all of the speeches that he had unearthed, Rutherford had the second most frequent speaker.
Wow, Guy, can you tell us about you mentioned it, and I'm looking in the book and I can't find it, which is always what happens to me when I'm trying to do this on the fly. But there was a debate, perhaps involving church government, but I'm not sure, where his comment was that, you know, 8 years of learning or whatever was swept away. And everybody saw that there was a piece of paper in his hand.
That was actually George Gillespie who did that. Rutherford from.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Right. From what I understand, from what I remember, Rutherford was the one who kind of leaned over I think it was Selden who was espousing Erastianism.
Yes, that's it.
The Erastian
right.
view, and Rutherford leaned over and said, "Rise, George, and defend the cause of Christ to rule His church and to govern His church." And so Gillespie stood and delivered.
He defended.
And did it well, and just destroyed Selden. And Selden said, "Yes, he undid my whole lifetime, of research and work and learning just in this one speech."
Wow!
And what was on the piece? The piece of paper was Da Lumine or Luminate Domine, which means give light, O Lord, right?
That's right. Da Lucum Domine, that's correct.
Lucum, that's right. Lucum. Give light,
everyone,
O Lord.
Everyone assumed he would be like us, and Gillespie would have been writing down his notes and bullet points as to what he was going to say when he obliterated Selden, only to find that he wasn't writing notes. He was just simply praying and saying, give light, help me.
Right. Now, Gillespie, was he the youngest of the Scotch members of the assembly or advisors, commissioners?
I think he was. I don't remember exactly his dates. He died, from what I remember, during the assembly in the 1640s, and I think he was in his 40s. When he died, so he might have been close to Rutherford's age. I can't remember his birth.
I was going to ask you, how old was Rutherford at the time of the assembly?
Rutherford was born in 1600, so he would have been 42, 43 when the assembly started.
Mm. Wow.
Young pup.
That's right. Real young.
You have a pretty interesting section in this work on the covenant of works and covenant of grace under the chapter on soteriology. And I know most of our listeners will be aware that Rutherford had the volume, The Covenant of Life, open. What I found interesting is you have a pretty extensive discussion about the fact that the Arminians believed in a covenant of grace as well, which is interesting to me, considering where we are theologically all over the spectrum, even in the broad Calvinistic world today, but that the way they understood grace and law was different than the way the Reformed and specifically Rutherford understood grace and law. Could you talk about that a little bit?
The Arminians believed that there was the covenant of grace was a universal a covenant that changed, if you will, everyone, and was gracious toward everyone, and put everyone in this condition of being able to respond to God in and of themselves.
And that's something that Wesley picks up with his prevenient grace, right?
Yes, that would be correct.
And people are surprised, people that hear just generic characterizations of Arminians, you know, when you just get into studying Calvinism, oftentimes people never understand that Arminians, many of them, the Wesleyan variety, do believe in a total depravity. But they also believe in this universal application of the atonement to people back into a state in which they can respond to the gospel.
That's right.
Correct. Prevenient grace,
mm-hmm.
the grace that goes before.
That's right. And that's also what gets to where we're talking about justification and the view of faith. Because things have been brought to this condition of being able to choose God in and of yourself because of the application of the atonement to all mankind. Now faith is different, and faith can do what's in us. You see, that's the aspect that Russell was picking up on, that there's faith can be something that we do. We can choose, apart from the Holy Spirit, if you will, specifically working in my heart, obviously generally working through the covenant of grace or through application of the atonement to all mankind. But now I individually can respond and choose God for myself, put my faith in the Lord Jesus Christ for myself. And Rutherford was looking at that and applying that to justification and saying, well, wait a minute, we've got a problem here at the very heart and center of what has been Reformed theology and what the Reformation was all about.
And bound up in this was also the necessity, right? The Arminians basically argued that God had to enter into a covenant of grace with all men, and Rutherford wants to protect the voluntary nature of God toward his creature, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
That brings up a point which is interesting, and that is very often, and Rutherford would be probably caricatured this way, but Calvinists or Reformed folk are often characterized as being philosophically driven, and Arminians are just plain, ordinary, simple, Bible-believing Christians. And yet, when you read Arminius, it's many of the immediate successors of Arminius, it's obvious that they are just as scholastic
Absolutely.
As the Reformed scholastics. And when you read, I mean, the first time I read Muller's book on Arminius, my head spun, right? Because I wasn't familiar with all the technical terminology.
Absolutely.
And if you want, and between, if you're wanting to get proof of that, just read the works of Arminius, which are available from Baker, and you can read the book by Muller on Arminius's doctrine of God, which will, if you've already read Muller, I think, and you're comfortable with the post-Reformation Reformed dogmatics, you'll be much more comfortable. But when I had read his book on Arminius, I had not yet, I was still a Wesleyan Arminian. I had not read any of his other works, and that one just blew my mind. But definitely, Arminius himself was no simple non-scholastic.
Yeah. Right. He was no simple Bible-believing, you know, no creed but Christ, or, you know, kind of
right.
a
Not at all.
No creed but the Bible type of a guy. You know, I mean, Rutherford loved the Word, and Rutherford loved Christ, and I think those were some of the things that that really drew me to Rutherford. Yes, he was very fixated, if you will. He was very intolerant towards error and things like that, but that was because of his love for God and his love for Christ. And you know, we don't see a whole lot of that today. We see a love for self, or a love for, you know, material possessions, or a love for this or a love for that, for family or for wife or for kids. But you know, that is one of the things that just enthralled me with Rutherford, was to see a man who loved God, who knew God, who walked with God, right, and who loved Christ, and wanted to love Christ in the same way he did.
The letters, I think, would bear that out, right? The book the most people would be familiar with would be Rutherford's letters.
That's correct. That's correct.
Also, I was going to say, yes, that's right. Banner of Truth has there's a short version.
Selection of them.
Full. Yeah, there's a full edition. Now, one of the comments I wanted to make, I think it's in the last chapter, chapter 5, where you deal with what is maybe called the Pyrrhonian or Erasmian skepticism that kind of went along with this rise of Arminianism. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I was simply, in the last chapter, what I'm doing is trying to draw things to a head and trying to show that there were this idea, what I was talking about before, about how Arminianism came into Scotland, and it came into Scotland wed with Episcopacy on the one hand, and that there were these two strands of Arminianism. One was was the Dutch strand, if you will, and the other was the Scottish strand. And in Scotland, like I said, it came into the Arminianism that was coming into Scotland was wed with Episcopacy. But my other point, I guess, is the fact that Arminianism was running two different ways. It was leading to, in the end result, two different things. The Arminianism that was coming into Scotland, that was wed together with Arminian, with Episcopacy, was leading to a return to Rome, so to speak. And they saw that as nothing more or less than a return to Rome, less the Pope. But the other thing was the other end, or the other thing that Arminianism they saw leading to, was this Pyrrhonian uncertainty, this Pyrrhonian vacillation, I guess is what they would call it. And what they saw was this idea of a liberty of prophesying, a freedom that they had to go above and beyond Scripture, in a sense. A liberty of prophesying that would undercut, if you will, enable Scripture to be treated as a nose of wax, and to be shaped and to be embraced or interpreted in any number of
ways. Right.
That's probably the main concern that Rutherford had. If you undo Scripture, you are putting people into a perpetual fluctuation. You're putting people into a situation in which they will never be certain of the truth, or coming to a certain knowledge of the truth. And so I think Rutherford's main concern in Arminianism was not just the fact that in Scotland it was running towards papacy, it was running towards Roman Catholicism and a return to Rome, but that eventually
leading
to a destruction of the faith.
Well, what interested me, Guy, was that the more things change, the more they stay the same. It struck me as reminding me of our own so-called postmodern age, right, where skepticism is all the rage. And of course, that some of that mindset went back to Erasmus. And anybody here, any of our listeners who's actually read Luther's On the Bondage of the Will, will know how he dealt with Erasmus's skepticism quite well, I think. Thank you very much. But also, what struck me was that despite what some people say, epistemological and religious certainty is not the brainchild of the Enlightenment.
That's right.
Which is very often there's a certain book out there on Scripture, which I will not name, which makes just that kind of argument.
That's right.
Yeah, I know we have to go soon, but I was wondering, and I'm hitting you off guard a little bit here, but in the Examen, does Rutherford set out his view of eschatology? We had Jeff Jew on this past year to talk about the eschatology of the divines, and I'm just wondering what you found in Rutherford in regard to his views of eschatology.
Well, actually, that is probably the one chapter that is not translated yet.
You're waiting until the end.
Waiting until the end. I'm like Calvin. I'm going to leave off Revelation, you know. And
yes, it is. you're going to be like Calvin in that you will not comment on the Book of Revelation.
So you see, Rutherford was I myself and Rutherford were very much Calvinists. So we were very much in continuity with Calvin.
That much. Oh, wow. Well, we look forward to reading whatever may come of this. I really do hope this translation finds the light of day in the form of publication other than just in the journal. But it's very exciting just to hear about Samuel Rutherford and all of your work and studying him and exposing him to us. So thanks for taking the time today just to speak with us about him.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoy speaking about Rutherford, as you can imagine, and I appreciate doing it with people who are like-minded.
Yes. Well, Rutherford we can learn much from, and we really need to read these men, especially this time in Presbyterianism, the 17th century. It's so rich, and oftentimes we're so fascinated with the new, we forget that there are quite a few really good books from the 17th century that we haven't read and that aren't even available to us as English speakers.
As C.S. Lewis once said, we need to let the clean sea breeze of the ages blow through our minds.
I think he even said, along with that, that every third or so, maybe every other book needs to be outside of our own century.
That's right.
And I think there's a lot of wisdom to that. And as Jeff mentioned already, the more things change, the more things stay the same. And these men are dealing with a lot of the same problems that we deal with today, just in slightly different forms and slightly different names. Well, I want to mention, other than Guy's books and articles, I'll have a list of those in their show notes available for download and purchase. You'll have them at your fingertips, but you can visit us at reformedforum.org. You can get, along with the show notes, news and information about our other programs. And I want to encourage you to go back to the archives as well. We have several programs. We've been doing this for about a year and a half. This is episode 83, so unless you've been with us from the beginning, there's quite a bit of material out there that you can listen to, and I'd encourage you to go listen to that. You can also visit Nick and the rest of us at feedingonchrist.com, and we have a slew of links and all sorts of stuff so you can follow along and get your fill of Reformed theology, if there is such a thing as a fill of Reformed theology. We want to thank everybody for listening. We hope that you come back again on Christ the Center.